The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Hi, everybody. Wait, let me get up a minute. 1 second. Yeah, I listen to Nicole Sandler. Is it time for the Nicole Sandler show?
No.
Oh, I forgot to turn the computer on.
Come on, man.
Let me just walk over here and I'll boot up my computer because I don't want... Oh, crap, I just... Never mind, it's okay, I got another one. Leave it there, the cat will get it. Got a little tune here, a little song to sing for you. That Nicole, she does something. She's really there and does things. Nicole Sandler Show.
Oh, it's a Monday. All right. Welcome to it. Mondays, you know. For those of you who are watching on video, you notice I'm kind of doing the Randy Rhodes thing. I've got the handheld mic because the boom that my microphone is on occasionally comes undone. It's a pain in the ass. So I guess I'll deal with this until I can fix it without playing something. Whatever. Hi, welcome to a Monday. So Friday things got a little bit away from us, and I did not get around to playing the interview that I had recorded to air on Friday. An interview with a guy named Luke Mogelson, who is a war correspondent. This is a guy who spends his life covering, covering wars around the world. Well, when he was noticing what was happening here at home, he decided he needed to get back here. When I'm talking about what was happening, I'm talking about the rise of the right-wing crazies. He saw what happened in Charlottesville. He saw what was going on, around the Trumpers and the QAnon crazies and the rest of the maggots. And he said, there's something brewing there. I need to be there to cover this. And he arrived back in the U.S., in time to be at the Michigan State House, just as a group of, I don't even know what to call them, terrorists, domestic terrorists, were plotting to infiltrate the Capitol, kidnap the governor, and probably assassinate her. So we will talk with Luke Mogelson, actually already did. We'll play it coming up in about 20 minutes or so. Before we get there, I don't want to run out of time. That's what happened on Friday. We were so busy that I didn't have a chance. I couldn't fit everything in. So today, I'm torn. I'm not sure if I keep going on the DeSantis death sentence asylum seeker Martha's Vineyard story, or if I go into Herschel Walker mode. I think the Herschel Walker thing is going to be pretty evergreen. Well, so is the DeSantis is fucked up story because, hello, some things never change. But you know what? I got to continue that. Hold the Herschel Walker thought. We will get there. He and Reverend Warnock, Senator Warnock to you, will have a debate on October 14th. And Herschel Walker was mouthing off about it. But that we've got time for that one. What we don't have time to waste on is this story that blew up last week when my idiot for governor, you know, the man I call affectionately, moron death sentence, decided that Governor Abbott of Texas and Ducey of Arizona were getting all the good attention because they were, you know, they're border states and people were coming across the border. And here's what happens. Yes, a lot of people are coming across the border from places where, unbelievably, the situation is worse than it is here. Go figure. Many of them now are coming up from Venezuela. In fact, the 50 or so that DeSantis shipped on a charter plane up to Martha's Vineyard, they were all from Venezuela. By the way, Florida has a huge Venezuelan population. I'm wondering how they're feeling about him. I need to try to go onto Facebook and find like a Venezuelan group from the town of Weston, which is just a couple of towns down the road and very heavily Venezuelan. Only I started researching it too late, but I will continue on that front because I'd love to hear from some of these Venezuelan refugees who are living here now, who've made this their home, and see what they think about this idiot stunt. But another day. Again, that story is not going anywhere either. But, you know, on Friday, when we were telling the story, and the migrants, the asylum seekers, have since left the island of Martha's Vineyard to go to nearby and equally beautiful Cape Cod, where there is a military base, where they're equipped to give them housing and, you know, help these people to get to where they need to go so they can continue their quest for asylum. That's what it's about. They are asylum seekers who enter the country, believe it or not, despite what they tell you on the Fox Not News channel, legally. There's a process. They can come across the border. They can fill out the first tranche of paperwork to apply for asylum because they're coming from a place that is that's not a good place. Let's put it that way. And you know, this is their job now for the next couple of years, because it takes that long, to convince whoever it is over here that, yes, they are legitimately in need of asylum. They can't go back to their home countries for fear of persecution or death. And they make the case. While the paperwork is in motion, once they've filed for asylum, they are legally allowed to remain here for as long as it takes, as long as they check in at all their designated appointments and stuff. Well, one of the things that these idiots did, and by the idiots, I'm not talking about the migrants, I'm talking about the, you know, DeSantis and his minions. They lied to these people and told them, well, they told them they will get all kinds of stuff, despite the fact that a lot of these people, once they're in the system and the process has begun, they have appointments scheduled. And some of these people had appointments on the other side of the country scheduled for this morning. Again, that's because they were lied to. And, you know, there's a guy named Judd Legum who has a Substack newsletter called Popular Information that you should be subscribing to if you're not already. And Judd Legum got a hold of a brochure that they gave to the people as they were getting on the plane or before, to entice them, to coerce them into getting on this plane. And he published it for us. So here it is. I will post the photographs, the images on the blog along with today's show. It'll be at NicoleSandler.com/9-19-22. So you can see them for yourself, but you can see it's a two-sided, probably 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper. It folds into thirds and it's printed in both English and Spanish. And on the front, it says Massachusetts Refugee Benefits. Massachusetts welcomes you, and a map of the state. And that's repeated in Espanol on the back. And then there's other information in the middle. Now, on the other side, on the inside of the brochure, that's where we get all the information. And oh boy, it looks like these people were promised all kinds of things that they will never be getting. So let me pull this up to a point where I can read it for you, because the print is awfully tiny here. So they're promised 8 months worth of money. Wait, hold on. I need to actually pull up these pictures so I can share them with you. What did I do with? I'm so organized and I get everything all laid out. And then I realize, damn, I need those. I need those pictures. So they're under Martha's Vineyard. But anyway, so these people, and again, you know, you're thinking, well, they don't speak English. They can't read. The brochures are printed in English and Spanish. And here we go. Okay, so the inside of this brochure promises, tells these people that they're going to get all kinds of cool stuff, including, here we go. All right. Resettlement agencies who resettle refugees under the Match Grant Program provide cash assistance and in-kind support for refugees for an additional 90 days beyond the normal 30-day period for reception and placement assistance. Employment for refugees, programs and services for eligible populations seeking employment. You know, a lot of these, it looks like they're just statements just flung onto the page because they don't, they're not in any cohesive order or anything. Refugee cash assistance provides up to 8 months of cash assistance for income eligible refugees without dependent children who reside in Massachusetts. Okay. What they don't tell you is none of them are eligible. Refugee Employment Services provides targeted services for both early employment and long-term self-sufficiency through an integrated model, including blah, 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 blah. And you know what? It's all bullshit. It says during the first 90 days after a refugee's arrival in Massachusetts, resettlement agencies provide basic needs support, including assistance with housing. Wait, I think I have my buzzer here, don't I? Because I think I need it handy. Assistance with housing, furnishings, foods, and other basic necessities, clothing and transportation to job interviews and job training, assistance in applying for social security cards, registering children for school, using public transportation facilities and services, community and cultural orientation. This is all
bullshit.
It's all bullshit. And this is what death sentence gave to these people. Let me share with you a little bit more from Judd Legum's popular info, because it's really sad. What he says is, let me give you a little background here. Last Wednesday, two planes landed in Martha's Vineyard and dropped off about 50 migrants from Venezuela. DeSantis quickly took credit. The migrants were used as political pawns in the hope of provoking a negative reaction from a liberal community. DeSantis even said, quote, "When people are brought to their front door, they go berserk. Their virtue signaling is fraud." I guess I could do this again. Yeah, the people in Martha's Vineyard did not go berserk. Instead, they rallied together to provide shelter, food, clothing, and other necessities for the group. On Friday, Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker facilitated their voluntary relocation to Joint Base Cape Cod, which is a, quote, safe, temporary accommodation appropriate for the specific needs of families and individuals. Now, Judd Legum points out that this charter flight appears to be inspired by a July 26th Tucker Carlson monologue from his show on the Fox Not News channel, in which the notoriously xenophobic host suggested sending migrants to Martha's Vineyard in, quote, huge numbers. And for good measure, DeSantis sent along a videographer. So Fox Not News obtained, quote, exclusive footage of the migrants' arrival. But this article goes on to tell about how the migrants were received in Martha's Vineyard, which was in a loving, compassionate, human way. But then he writes, in the aftermath of the flights, a key issue of contention is whether the migrants boarded the flights freely and voluntarily. While DeSantis and his administration repeatedly referred to migrants as illegal immigrants, the migrants surrendered to immigration officials after crossing the border into Texas. They are, this is what I told you before, they are now seeking asylum from the repressive authoritarian regime in Venezuela. The migrants are legally permitted to remain in the United States while their cases are being considered by the immigration courts, and they're able to voluntarily travel within the country. But many of them told reporters that they were misled about the nature of the flight. Several migrants told NPR that they were told the flight was going to Boston, not Martha's Vineyard. According to the migrants, a woman who identified herself as Perla also said that if they traveled to Boston, they could receive, quote, expedited work papers. Yeah. The allegation that the migrants were misled is legally significant. It would mean that the flights were not just heartless, but potentially criminal. If the migrants were misled, the scheme to transport them to Martha's Vineyard could constitute fraud, false imprisonment, or kidnapping. The lawyer, Susan Church, told Politico, quote, there's absolutely the possibility of both civil and criminal liability if people were lied to about where they were going or what they were going to get when they got there. Now, DeSantis has been adamant that the migrants were not misled. He claims that they were provided with a map showing the destination was Martha's Vineyard. And he describes the flights as all voluntary. Well, popular information. This is Jed Legum's blog site, Substack, obtained that brochure that I just read to you that was provided to these people who ultimately agreed to the flights. It was provided to Judd Legum by Lawyers for Civil Rights, LCR. That's a Boston-based legal organization that's representing 30 of the passengers on this plane. It says they're going to get 8 months cash assistance, assistance with housing, food, clothing, transportation, all that stuff, applying for Social Security cards and many other benefits. None of this, however, is true.
Come on, man.
Yeah. Matt Cameron, another Boston-based immigration attorney, explained that the benefits described in the brochure are resettlement benefits available to refugees who have been referred by the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees and authorized to live in the United States. These benefits are not available in Massachusetts to the migrants who boarded these flights who are still in the process of seeking asylum. This lawyer said these people absolutely do not have access to cash, housing, and other resettlement benefits, which are provided through federal funds and partnerships with faith-based organizations. The brochure, which is crudely designed to resemble a government document, does not explain that these benefits described are only available to specially designated refugees. But according to some of these migrants, the benefits were also promised verbally by this woman, Perla, to lure them onto the planes chartered by DeSantis. One migrant, Eduardo Linares, who ultimately declined not to get on the plane, told the Texas Tribune, quote, they told us that they were going to help us with the rent to get a job. That was the only option left to us. Well, that was a lie. And so the story goes on like this. On Saturday, this law firm wrote to U.S. Attorney Rachel Rollins and Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey, calling on them to open a formal investigation. In a letter, they said individuals working in concert with state officials, including the Florida governor, made numerous false promises to their clients, including of work opportunities, schooling for their children, and immigration assistance in order to induce them to travel. Those who had induced our clients to travel under these false pretenses disappeared, leaving our clients to learn that the offers of assistance had all been a ruse to exploit them for political purpose. And shocker upon shockers, I tell you, the story ends with this line. DeSantis' office did not respond to a request for comment about the brochure. Of course they didn't, because they're lying, thieving crooks. And they're taking advantage of these people. And DeSantis says this is only the beginning. He's just getting started. Oh, and Donald Trump weighed in and he said, he stole my idea. It was my idea to send those people to Martha's Vineyard. It was my idea. He stole it. Ugh. Can we say ugh again? Ugh. Okay. I don't know about you, but I'm ready to hear this interview that we didn't hear on Friday. We'll have a little time on the end, so stick around. And plug in, because this is a really important conversation. Luke Mogelson is known as you're a war correspondent. You've spent most of your career overseas covering conflicts around the world. And And you decided, looking at what's happening in the United States, that it was time to come back here to cover what's going on here?
That's right, yeah.
Was there one thing that made you go, wait a minute, something strange is happening there? Or was it just the abundance of craziness that's been going on for the last few years here?
It was actually early on in the pandemic in April of 2020. I was living in France at the time, and I'd actually just returned from an assignment in Syria. And I saw the images and footage from Michigan where armed militias had occupied the state house in Lansing, you might recall. And there were these really striking photographs and videos of these guys accosting lawmakers and facing off against police in front of the barred doors of the legislature. And they had, you know, semi-automatic rifles and flak jackets and tactical gear. And so when I saw that, I thought I better get a plane ticket to Michigan.
And you did, and you almost immediately went there. And this was the site of, I mean, just a really strange story that I frankly never thought we'd hear about in the United States, where this group of people plotted to kidnap and perhaps assassinate the governor of Michigan because basically they don't like her politics.
Yeah, and I actually met and encountered at some of these events the folks who were accused of being part of that plot. Should just say here that one of the alleged ringleaders, Adam Fox, his first trial ended in a mistrial because his defense successfully argued that, you know, the heavy-handed tactics of the FBI had essentially amounted to entrapment. They had a lot of undercover FBI agents infiltrating the group and pushing them to incriminate themselves was the argument. And, you know, interestingly, that tactic was actually developed by the FBI in the wake of 9/11 to target Muslim Americans. And was very, very successfully used to put in prison for very long sentences a lot of American Muslims who never committed any crimes. There's an irony here because it was that was part of this kind of general atmosphere of Islamophobia in the wake of 9/11 that contributed to the rise of some of these very groups, including the militias that that were part of this plot.
It's astounding. And the first, as you mentioned, the first trial did end in a mistrial. And all I could think is, wow, now everything is falling apart over here. So Luke Mogelson, you come back from overseas, you jump right into the fire. The result is this new book just released this week called The Storm Is Here, An American Crucible. Pretty damning indictment of things over here. And after spending so many years in war zones, was it culture shock when you came back and saw how much had changed here?
Yeah, I mean, it was depressing, especially the end of my reporting towards the after the election and towards January 6th. There were two previous rallies in D.C. before January 6th, on November 14th and December 12th. And in some ways, those were even more demoralizing for me as a citizen than the attack on the Capitol, because you had the same groups targeting, you know, random black pedestrians, guys with flak jackets and Confederate flags, you know, harassing black citizens in broad daylight, steps from the White House, and police looking on, not doing anything. I saw them vandalize a historic black church where Frederick Douglass's funeral had been held, and attack and vandalize gay-owned businesses. So there was a lot of ugliness even before January 6th that had kind of been overlooked by the press and also by law enforcement, which was why they got caught so flat-footed on the day of the insurrection.
Right. You know, there's one line as I started reading the book and reading the information around the book, the one line jumped out at me. You said, "I developed a fascination with the disconnect between the incredible violence and upheaval that the U.S. created abroad and its relative peace and prosperity at home." That is a disconnect that most people don't shine a spotlight on. We are responsible for a lot of the conflicts around the world, and yet it seems like those conflicts don't or haven't historically touched us here because we're removed from so much of the action. This is a wholly different source. I mean, we did bring it on ourselves, you could say, but it's like the danger is coming from inside the house, you know, like every horror movie out there. Now, another thing that got to me was you mentioned in all these war zones that you've had really good personal one-on-one conversations with people, that when you go directly to people in a war zone, what you hear is not necessarily what we hear on the news. And I'm wondering if you got an inkling of what's happening here abroad, if you heard about authoritarian uprisings from happening here at home while you were overseas.
No, I mean, on the contrary, I would say that, as you mentioned, I always had this sense of a disconnect between, you know, what I was witnessing abroad, witnessing my country do abroad, and the peace and prosperity at home. And as you mentioned, you know, Americans have been incredibly and deliberately insulated from their foreign conflicts, you know, be it in Iraq, Afghanistan, or Syria. And it's something that my friends in those countries have often remarked on. You know, right before the pandemic, actually when the COVID-19 first appeared in very early 2020, in January, February, I was actually in Syria reporting on Raqqa, which we had, the U.S. had completely obliterated. I mean, it's a scale of destruction unprecedented in our time. An entire city wiped off the face of the map, like Dresden. Mm-hmm. And you know, very few Americans even know about that. I had also reported on the offensive while it was happening, and there were only a couple reporters there at the time because, you know, Americans were just no longer interested in these activities overseas. And for, you know, Syrians and Iraqis, it's frustrating. And there in Raqqa in particular, my friend Sangar was telling me, you know, he told me it's not fair. Nothing ever happens to the U.S. And it wasn't as if Sangar, you know, wanted something bad to happen to the U.S. It was just that he couldn't understand how such incredible destruction and violence could be perpetrated, you know, consistently over two decades by a country, and none of it ever coming back to bite it. So, you know, when some of this agitation started and social fracturing started to happen in the U.S., it did feel a little bit like things coming full circle. And you know, it's probably worth noting that veterans of these wars wield an outsized influence in groups like the Proud Boys, the Three Percenters, the Oath Keepers, the very outfits that, you know, spearheaded January 6th.
Right. And that's a frightening fact to reconcile when you think about, you know, and a lot of there's a lot of police officers in those groups as well. I live in Florida, in South Florida, and the Proud Boys have basically taken over the Miami-Dade Republican Party. So I have a theory. I call it opposite world, that nothing makes sense. Everything is turned on its head. And part of it, I'm guessing, by spending so many years overseas in war zones and talking with the people, you pick up on more of the disconnect. I mean, I think America is completely insulated. In fact, you know, most people have no idea what's happening in combat zones because we don't have a draft anymore. They're not personally involved. I was interested in the part where in late 2020, you say you were in northern Syria. This was when Trump ordered the immediate withdrawal of all U.S. troops, basically leaving our allies, the Kurds, in a really precarious, bad situation. And again, over here, and with the mis and disinformation perpetrated by the right, by Fox and other outlets like that, people were siding with the Russians, not understanding that the Kurds had been doing our bidding over there. They worked with us for decades, and we left them in a really bad situation. Yet, you know, the pile on with our withdrawal from Afghanistan, which was clumsy and bad all around, the pile on was strong. Are you noticing that the political coverage seeped into the attitudes overseas as well?
Overseas, I mean, I think that most, with the example that you cited, I think that a lot of Syrians and certainly Kurds, but also our Syrian Arab allies were really confused. And it felt quite contradictory, because Trump, you know, during his campaign and early in his presidency invoked a lot of bellicose rhetoric about bombing the shit out of ISIS. And so you know, people, I think, just they felt a deep sense of betrayal. But for me, what was more surprising, I mean, obviously the frustration of Kurds and other Syrians is logical and understandable. But what I always had trouble kind of wrapping my mind around was why more Republican and conservative veterans of these conflicts didn't feel betrayed when Trump, you know, carelessly withdrew from Syria and also in Afghanistan, you know, when he basically, when he started negotiating with the Taliban and really just dismissing, giving up on the war in Afghanistan, which, you know, whether or not you agree with it, with that policy, just hit the way that he talked about the war in Afghanistan and his dismissiveness of, you know, the sacrifices that both Afghan and American soldiers had made over 20 years. I was always surprised by how little that bothered right-wing American veterans who had fought in Afghanistan. And, you know, I came around to, after spending time with them, I came around to feeling that, you know, for them, they didn't really care that much either about the fate of Syria or Afghanistan or Iraq. For them, it was, you know, what was most important was kind of their identities as members of the warrior class and people within that 1% of Americans who of the citizenry who had volunteered after 9/11. And what you had with groups like the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers was a situation in which they were offered the opportunity to kind of reclaim that warrior status in the U.S. and fight against this evil, you know, antagonist and threat on the home front, which for the people who join those movements, the veterans who join those movements, immediately and vastly eclipsed their concerns about, the wars overseas.
Wow. Yes, the level of delusion, I think, is fascinating. And when you see how many members of, it's so weird. When I talk about opposite world, it encompasses everything, the way they project their feelings on the rest of us. The fact that they are pointing fingers at Antifa and Black Lives Matter as the, the problem here in the States, when mm-hmm. Antifa... it stands for anti-fascist. I mean, I'm Antifa, right? I'm the danger here, according to them. When it's this propaganda, it's this disinformation, it's this rise of this this authoritarian type of attitude. Again, I live in Florida. Our governor, Ron DeSantis, is doing things that are frightening, that in normal times would have him in a straitjacket, I would think. So you're seeing this rise in conjunction with this propaganda campaign. I know you weren't covering wars, you weren't over in Europe for World War II, but do you see the correlation there, the similarities between what was happening in the 30s with the rise of Hitler with the rise of fascism?
Well, I don't know if I'd go that far. I think that, there's a danger and kind of the impulse to compare whatever tribulations we're experiencing with Nazism, because you see a lot of that actually on the right. One of the things I was surprised by when I showed up in Michigan, even early on in the pandemic in the spring of 2020, before things got really crazy, even at that early stage, many of the anti-lockdowners I spoke with were comparing just, the public health policies of the Democratic governor, Gretchen Whitmer, to, the activities of the Nazis in the Third Reich, and they were sincere in that. It wasn't hyperbole. Wow. They really believed that, they were faced with a comparable oppressor. And, once you kind of put things in that framework and view your enemy as evil incarnate or as a threat, equatable with Hitler, mm-hmm. that allows you to rationalize all kinds of anti-democratic activity yourself. And, that's why the rioters on January 6th did what they did, because they felt like the threat was commensurate with such a drastic action, and they genuinely believed that, they were righteous. So I'm reluctant, to make those comparisons, whether it's the right or the left doing it, just because it leads to a kind of a duality where it's good against evil.
Yeah.
And once you see the world that way, you end up permitting yourself to commit all kinds of egregious actions.
Right. I see that. Luke Mogelson is with us. We're talking about his new book, The Storm Is Here. It is here. And so you were there. You were in D.C. on January 6th. You were filming a lot of the crazy stuff going on your cell phone. You witnessed a lot of things as a journalist that must have been shocking to you. But the thing that stands out to me is, as usual, the fact that these people, as you just said, believed what they'd been told. They believed they were on a righteous effort to keep the integrity of the U.S. government, because they were told this election had been stolen. Again, totally discounting the good work of journalists, instead quoting the propaganda that's out there. And because our news media, everything is so fragmented now, these people only get their so-called news from sources that I would contend are not news. Fox is not news, despite their name. And so when there's such a distrust of the media, such distrust of, you know, the government, such distrust of the norms that we've lived under, this is what results. Were you surprised by the extent of what was happening when you followed them into the Capitol? Did you expect that that day would wind up like this?
Not exactly like that. I didn't know that it would end with an attack on the Capitol, but I was anticipating large-scale violence just because, you know, I had been at these previous rallies in D.C. with the same people on November 14th and December 12th and witnessed them, you know, committing violence and witnessed also just the rage building. And not just since then, but on, you know, November 7th, I was in Harrisburg at the state, the Pennsylvania state capitol, with where armed 3%er militias and other groups rallied and said this was the day that the election was called for Biden. And even then, they were saying that they weren't going to accept it, that they would go to war if they had to, that there was a line in the sand. So, and then going back even earlier to November 3rd and 4th, the day of the election, I was in Detroit at the convention center where absentee ballots were being counted and where a mob, a Republican mob, descended on the room where the exhibition hall where election workers were counting ballots. And there as well, you know, before the Trump had even lost the election, they were saying that, you know, they weren't going to accept a Biden win. So it was clear, you know, that something was going to happen. But on the day of January 6th, the only outstanding question was what form that violence would take and how that rage would be expressed exactly. And that was resolved the moment Trump said in his speech from the Ellipse that they should all go to the Capitol.
Right. And then you just followed them going wherever the crowd took you?
Pretty much. Yeah. I followed them up the mall from the Washington Monument to the U.S. Capitol building. And by the time I got there, there were already violent skirmishes happening at the foot of the steps between Capitol police officers and Trump supporters. There was blood on the stone tiles. There, you know, Trump supporters were pelting the officers with bottles and other projectiles, brawling with their fists. A big bleacher had been erected over the steps and ahead of the inauguration ceremony. And so you basically, to get up to the Capitol building, you had to go underneath, like through the understructure of the bleachers. And that's what the police officers were protecting and trying to, that's the line they were trying to hold at that moment. So I was there when the Trump supporters breached that line, went up the steps. There were more violent skirmishes underneath the bleachers. They breached that second line and came up onto a big open terrace. And that's where one of the Proud Boys shattered a window with a riot shield that he had stolen from a Capitol police officer. And everyone began streaming in into the building through that broken window. And that's how I went in. I followed them in through the broken window into the Capitol building, then followed them through several other chambers and hallways up to the central rotunda. And there were other skirmishes there with more police and a mob trying to come in from the east side, the other side of the Capitol, where there was another big entrance. And I saw them eventually breach that door as well. And that's where the Oath Keepers came in. And then I followed other groups, you know, to the what ended up being, although I didn't know that's where they were going at the time, but the Senate chamber.
Right.
And I ended up inside the Senate chamber with a group of Trump supporters.
With the shaman and all those people that we saw in there?
The Jacob Chansley, yes. The Q shaman, yeah, with his headdress with horns and no shirt.
That was just surreal. I mean, watching from out here, it was frightening and a feeling that I'd never had before. I can only imagine what it felt like being there as it's unfolding. It's got to be surreal and just unbelievable. How about when you came upon the gallows set up outside the Capitol? What kind of feeling does that evoke? It's got to feel like this can't be this country that I've come to know for all these decades.
Yeah, surreal is a pretty good word to use for it. Very darkly surreal. There were so many moments throughout that day, which I depict in the book in more detail, but there's just too many to recount, you know, like these almost dreamlike, bizarre scenes, rendered even more strange and dreamlike by the fact that they were taking place in these iconic spaces, you know, like the Senate chamber. Just the juxtaposition of this barbarian with no shirt and Viking tattoos and a horned headdress, like, you know, giving a prayer from the vice president's chair on the Senate dais, with his surroundings was just and then also, some of the bizarre interactions inside the building between the intruders and law enforcement made everything very, very surreal, as you say.
Yeah. And, you know, you're right about, you use the word the disconnect. And that's what I kept seeing. And I get that you don't want to, you know, say what label one side good, the other side evil. But there's no disputing the fact that what was happening that day was evil that had been directed from the top, because these people, as we said before, really thought they were doing the righteous thing. They were protecting our democracy because they were told by the guy they trust that the election had been stolen, even though that's blatantly false. It leaves me, I, again, sitting here in my studio watching the events unfold that day, terrified. Now here we are. You know, it's a year and a half later, coming up on 2 years. Do you see things any differently? Do you see with more clarity? Are you less disturbed by what's happening, or are you more?
No, I think I'm more concerned, just because after January 6th, you know, there was a brief moment during which there seemed to be a possibility that mainstream Republicans would, you know, reject Trump and Trumpism, and that he had finally gone too far, and you know, there would be a kind of broad reckoning with the anti-democratic forces that he had unleashed. But I was, you know, relatively hopeful that that's what would happen. I even ended my article for the New Yorker about the day of the attack with the line, "The storm might be here." So I was hedging, you know, and hoping, but here we are, and that clearly didn't happen. The opposite has happened.
So the book is out. It published this week. You spent much of, you know, you've been living in France, I think, and covering wars and conflicts around the world. Where, if you could pick where on the planet you'd feel safest living, where would that be right now?
Oh, safest? Probably still, I don't know. Safest. I mean, I think the U.S., I don't think that Americans should be too concerned about their, you know, safety just yet. I think it's more, they should be concerned about a more incremental chipping away, an indelible chipping away of the democratic process.
right?
In the country.
Aren't we there? I mean, they've taken away our right, women's rights to do with our bodies what we think is best for us. They're trying to take away minorities' right to vote. They're taking away our right to history. I mean, I know, look, I know I sound very partisan. It's not a partisan thing. It's a small d democracy thing. They are trying to take us in a direction which is not, you know, separation of church and state, they're saying, was not the intention of the founders. So again, it's the opposite world thing. And I find danger lurking here on a lot of levels. One, the danger to our democracy, which is what the president was trying to warn about in a speech that they're vilifying. And while they scream about, you know, grooming and liberal indoctrination, they're changing our history books and civics lessons to teach something that's very foreign, which I find, again, frightening.
No, I agree with you. And I agree. And I guess the point I was trying to make is just that those are the things that I find most concerning and most pressing in the U.S. rather than, street level violence and personal bodily safety. And I think that, we shouldn't get too distracted by the threat of, some kind of open civil war conflict, because the real imminent danger that's underway right now is the use of actual institutions in the state to, as you say, diminish rights and undercut the democratic process.
Now, you're still a contributing writer for The New Yorker. What is next for Luke Mokelson? Are you going to go back overseas, or are you going to stay and cover what's unfolding here at home?
Well, I've been covering the war in Ukraine this year, so I'm planning on going back there pretty soon. And then maybe if I can get back in time, I'd like to cover the midterms and then see, what happens after that, because that will be, I think, pretty revealing of what direction the country's going to take.
You know, the old adage, may you live in interesting times. Sometimes I'd rather they not be so interesting, but I guess in your line of work, this is a good time to be working.
If I could choose, I'd rather, I'd take being out of work or having to cover fly fishing in Montana or something.
Right. I would say school board meetings, but no, because they're
I was going to say that too, but then thought better of it.
Exactly. Yeah. Great minds and all that. Well, Luke Mokelson, thank you so much. Thank you for writing this. Thank you for your turning your attention back here, because it seems like a lot of the media is afraid to take on what's happening here for fear of, of covering things objectively without doing the both sider stuff. I see what's going on at CNN right now, and it's kind of disturbing for me. Anyway, I appreciate your work. Luke Mokelson, the book is The Storm Is Here. And then the subtitle is An American Crucible. Last question is why an American crucible? What motivated that part of the title?
Well, it's actually kind of a sly reference to Michael Flynn, General Flynn, who you might be familiar with. He's a key leader in these movements, and really looked to for guidance by QAnoners and other far right groups. And he was crucial to pushing people towards attacking the Capitol on January 6th and undermining trust in elections and the democratic process. And I saw him at a couple events say that tell his followers that we're in a crucible moment in this country. And I agree with him, but for obviously different reasons. So it's just my participation in what you would call the opposite world.
It is opposite world, I'll tell you that. Luke Mokelson, thank you so much. It was a pleasure to talk to you. I really appreciate you coming on the show, and thank you for the book.
Thank you.
You know, I'm sorry that I immediately stop recording once if a recorded interview, once it ends, I immediately hit stop for a number of reasons, but one, so it eases the editing. It's done. But then he said, I really enjoyed that. You asked great questions. It's like, too bad I didn't have that video. Anyway, Luke Mogelson, he is the real deal. He is a very respected journalist, and this book is quite good. The Storm Is Here. And yeah, it is. On a number of levels, that title unfortunately works today. Puerto Rico was hit by Hurricane Fiona. It came ashore as a Category 1, and that should just tell you that no hurricane is a day at the beach. A Category 1 hurricane knocked out all the power to Puerto Rico yet again. Here they go again. And you'll hear at the end of the show, you know, after Progressive Voices goes, when the show proper ends, I play the What's News report, and it's the unabridged version. And today I do go into quite a length about what's happening in Puerto Rico. It's terrible. This storm totally just knocked everything out there. It's bad. And it's not only there. Japan has a typhoon heading their way, a really bad one. Hello, climate change. And it may not be climate change, but Mexico, the southwestern Pacific coast of Mexico, just in the last hour, was hit by a 7.6 earthquake. 7.6, that's huge. This was south of Manzanillo, and I've been all up and down the west coast of Mexico, and it's beautiful. You know, I've been Puerto Vallarta, Manzanillo. I used to date a guy who was into yacht racing, and so, you know, the big sailing racing, the yachts, they're called yachts. When I think of a yacht, I don't think of these racing boats. A yacht I think of is, you know, what the Russian oligarchs have that you go cruising the world on. These are racing. They're like the boats they race the America's Cup. So anyway, I did some of those, and I did Puerto Rico to Manzanillo. That's the area that was hit by this earthquake. They were talking about a tsunami. John Doe says, I didn't feel it. Now you're saying it's a 7.0. That's big. Whatever it is, it hit 2 p.m. East Coast. Yeah, that's 5 o'clock here. So, you know, the world is just kind of falling apart. And then I got to say, I'd be remiss if I didn't go here. Joe Biden, I haven't seen it yet, but he was on 60 Minutes last night. And, you know, Joe is prone to the gaffe. Well, 60 Minutes asked him about the pandemic. And Joe Biden actually said this.
The pandemic is over. We still have a problem with COVID. We're still doing a lot of work on it. But the pandemic is over. If you notice, no one's wearing masks. Everybody seems to be in pretty good shape. And so I think it's changing. And I think this is a perfect example of it.
No, Joe, no. The pandemic is not over. People are still wearing masks. In fact, you know, lung cancer survivor here. When I leave the house, I wear a mask. When we go out anywhere, I wear my N95 mask. I thought I had one sitting here, but I've got them all over the place. That's irresponsible for him to say the pandemic is over. It is not over. He said, well, we'll be living with COVID. We still have a pandemic going on. Be safe. And be safe for the people around you who might be immunocompromised, who depend on everyone else to do their fair share to keep them safe. That was just fucked up. That was wrong. Don't do it. Don't say it. And as for whether or not he'll run again, he said, well, maybe. I guess. Let's get past the midterms first, okay? Well, he didn't say COVID was over, but he said the pandemic is over. The pandemic is not over.
The pandemic is over.
No, it's not. Please, Joe, stop. All right. Tomorrow on the show, Marcy Wheeler returns. Laffy is still up in Canada trying to get this townhouse together. She's not ready to come back yet next week. But in her stead, Marcy Wheeler. I mean, you know, can I pull in a sub or can I pull in a sub? No. As you know, Marcy's great. And actually, we're going to tape early tomorrow morning. And then I'm going to tape my interview with Dar Williams. So if you've not yet gone online and found the song When I Was a Boy, that's your homework assignment for tonight. Although we're probably not going to hear that interview until Friday. It's all happening. All right. With that, the music is ending. The show is over. Thank you for listening. Thank you, Luke Mogelson. Have a great night. See you tomorrow. Marcy Wheeler time again. All right. Now, I'll leave you with the news. Thanks, everybody. See you tomorrow.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
The longest-serving monarch in British history, Queen Elizabeth II, died more than a week ago and finally today is put to rest. British and world leaders gathered for the funeral Monday morning in Westminster Abbey in London, finishing up a very long 10 days of national mourning. After signing a book of condolence and appearing on the balcony overlooking the coffin, President Biden said the Queen was, quote, decent, honorable, and all about service. He added, you were fortunate to have had her for 70 years. We all were. The world is better for her. Meanwhile, life goes on for the rest of us. And for many, that means dealing with yet another major disaster, like the people of Puerto Rico, who took a direct hit Sunday from Hurricane Fiona, hitting shore with maximum sustained winds of 85 miles per hour, knocking out power to the entire island. Now, the Luma Power Company said it could take several days to fully restore it. It's better than months. Forecasters warned that the storm could drench the island with historic rains of up to 25 inches in some pockets. Governor Pedro Pierluisi said the damages that we're seeing are catastrophic. Now, one thing I know for sure, President Biden will not head to the island to marvel that it's surrounded by water to give himself an A-plus grade on dealing with the disaster, nor will he pretend to help the people there by throwing paper towels at them. President Biden did sit for a 60 Minutes interview that aired Sunday night. It touched on a wide range of topics, but one unscripted remark has generated some backlash.
The pandemic is over. We still have a problem with COVID. We're still doing a lot of work on it, but the pandemic is over. If you notice, no one's wearing masks. Everybody seems to be in pretty good shape. And so I think it's changing, and I think this is a perfect example of it.
Yeah, that was a strange comment for the president to make, especially as he's struggling to get the approval of Congress for more funding for vaccines and treatments for COVID-19. Republicans reacted to Biden's comments by questioning why the government still designates COVID-19 as a public health emergency if the pandemic is over. It's not only the U.S. government and the CDC. The World Health Organization says it remains a public health emergency of international concern. Data shows that there are about 65,000 new COVID-19 cases reported each day over the last 2 weeks. But about 400 people in the U.S. are still dying every day from COVID-19. As a lung cancer survivor, I still wear my N95 mask whenever I go out in public. Just saying. The backlash against Florida's governor and 2024 presidential wannabe Ron DeSantis is escalating over the stunt he pulled last week when he flew some 50 refugees from Venezuela who had somehow traveled long, arduous journeys up to the southern border to legally apply for asylum in the U.S. DeSantis somehow, for some reason, rounded up 50 human beings in Texas, told them they were going to Boston where there would be food, housing, and jobs awaiting them. All lies. Instead, the governor of Florida took these people from Texas, flew them to the tiny island of Martha's Vineyard. Now, that's a summer vacation and tourist spot with no resources to accommodate a group of asylum seekers. The year-round residents who lived there in the off-season rallied and treated the migrants with compassion, care, and love, while they learned of the lies and deception used by DeSantis and his thugs to get them on the plane in the first place. Massachusetts State Representative Dylan Fernandez tweeted Sunday that he's requesting a criminal investigation of Governor DeSantis for, quote, inhumane acts connected to his decision to fly these immigrants to Martha's Vineyard. Lawyers for Civil Rights, which represents 30 of them, also demanded an investigation. The migrants, again, who had been in Texas, said they were lured onto the flight with false promises. Fernandez said not only is it morally criminal, there are legal implications around fraud, kidnapping, deprivation of liberty, and human trafficking. DeSantis, along with Texas Governor Greg Abbott and Arizona Governor Doug Ducey, all Republicans, have been sending migrants seeking asylum at the U.S.-Mexican border to so-called sanctuary cities. Unfortunately, we've got more than enough of these Neanderthal-resembling governors flexing their power. Like Virginia's Glenn Youngkin, who over the weekend unveiled new guidelines restricting the rights of transgender students in public schools. The rules restrict what bathrooms they can use and require teachers to use the pronouns associated with the gender students were assigned at birth. Students will also be barred from changing their legal name and gender without an official legal document or court order, quote, even upon written instruction of a parent or eligible student. The Virginia Department of Education's 2022 model policies roll back rules put in place by Youngkin's predecessor, Democrat Ralph Northam. Virginia is one of a growing number of states that have adopted new restrictions on gay and transgender students this year. If you're still one of those climate change deniers, pay attention. Alaska floodwaters began receding Sunday after the state's most violent storm in years. Remnants from a huge Pacific typhoon battered more than 1,000 miles of coastline, including some of the most remote areas of the United States. It could take days for authorities to get a full picture of widespread flood damage to houses and infrastructure. Scientists have expressed concerns that climate change would increase Alaska's risk of large non-tropical cyclones. But that's not the only place where this has happened. Typhoon Nan Madol drenched western Japan with record rainfall on Monday, with sustained winds of nearly 150 miles per hour. It then weakened, and finally its maximum winds are expected to continue falling as the storm pushes across Japan for the next day or two. State broadcaster NHK is reporting that one man was found dead inside a submerged car found in a field, and at least 82 people have been injured. Nearly 8 million people were ordered to evacuate vulnerable areas in southern and western Japan. And though it's not technically climate-related, a 6.9 magnitude earthquake shook southeastern Taiwan on Sunday, damaging or destroying a lot of buildings. At least one person died, 9 suffered minor injuries. A tsunami warning had been issued but was later lifted. The quake knocked out power to thousands of households.
Yeah.
And finally, Ukraine is still fighting back and Russia appears to be damaged. Ukraine has captured more territory in 1 week than Russian forces had in 5 months, according to some observers. The recent gains by Ukrainian troops have forced Russia to regroup amid a series of shortcomings. And with winter coming, it's only going to get more difficult for them. Russians currently hold about 20% of Ukrainian territory, including Crimea and parts of the south. But Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky on Sunday called any perceived slowing of his military's progress a preparation for more cities to be liberated soon. He said, quote, perhaps it seems to someone now that after a series of victories, we have a certain lull, but this is not a lull. This is preparation for the next sequence. Slava Ukraini. And that's just a bit of what's news. For now, I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on one of those donate buttons.